school when you're about 6 or 7, the world is the world you live in, isn't it? And the whole thing of language happens that, you know, people don't keep up their languages.
And also I thought it was quite significant that Mrs. Hart and Mrs. Driscoll, there is that solidarity, which I think was probably pretty strong amongst the women as well.
Well, there had to be. Women had to carry on this discourse for anything to be memorised. But I think they all did, that particular group in that particular period, people who would have been born just before the First War. Women, you know, would got the vote when they were in their 20s and had their children vaccinated. You know, they were...
Of course, they very rarely went to work if they had a family.
No, not allowed, not in a Catholic household, no. And of course, they're very intelligent, so we're talking about a different thing. We're talking about, you know, women who are bright as buttons, you know.
And the interesting thing about, for me, about Mrs. Driscoll is that clearly she's very unhappy. Today we might call it clinically depressed.
Yes, she would be on medication. I don't know whether she'd be any the better off, but she wouldn't have so many children today, and she'd be able to get out of the marriage if that's what she wanted to do. But of course, she doesn't want to do it. She's in love with her husband.
Yes, exactly. But
I think also mental illness then, though it's not talked about in the play, was seen to be a character defect, which is only now being questioned, isn't it, really?
And there was, in a sense, no vocabulary. What's interesting about your characters is you can see them and hear them struggling, a bit bewildered by their own experiences. Mm. She has what we would call a panic attack in the street, I think. But, of course, she doesn't have it, almost any words to be able to... you can feel her struggling to
express. She manages to describe it in a funny way, doesn't she?
Yeah. And there's also that horrific moment when she locks herself in her room, lies on the bed. And that presumably is also why, in the end, she kills herself.
I think that her anxiety was too much to bear. It's combined with a romantic unhappiness, but I would have thought it was probably that she could no longer bear the feeling, and there was an awful lot of that amongst people who were poor, with nothing but drink and no medication, no counselling. It wasn't, you know, I mean, there was no such thing.
And also I remember that sex roles were very sharply defined, so that the men used to go drinking together as men quite often.
Well, the men had to work very hard. People often forget that, you know, in this day. They had to work fantastically hard. You know, they had to work on Saturdays, and both parties had to work very hard. You wouldn't want to load a more than you could help it load timber into a boat. Do you know, because he would have been a docker, her husband. So, you know, that's the thing. And women had to work hard because there were no washing machines. And they were lucky if they had a mangle, some women. There were more... I think that whole thing of anxiety, which has been present... There was no vocabulary, as you said. There was nothing for people to do. There was not any... There was no... Well, I suppose there began to be tablets, didn't there, I think. The health service had just come in, I suppose, when the place starts.
On the other hand, they did have a family network, because, of course, when Mrs. Driscoll's in a fix, she gets her older daughter to take the kids down to...
And she has a neighbour who was as near as damaged, who got a talented sort of counselling quality. She can sit there and not... She doesn't judge the woman, she lets her...
Talk and encourages her.
Yes, she doesn't. She's... So they fulfil the functions for each other, because the older woman admires the younger woman. So they were very important to each other.
And also on the subject of the vocabulary, the climax of the play, of course, is when Gerard and Vincent meet again in later life.
Mm-hmm.
It's very painful and very emotional, and there's this sense of incompleteness, isn't there,
mm-hmm.
there? And yet, of course, they talk about love, actually, quite
mm-hmm.
openly. They don't talk about it like we would talk about it today.
Well, what seemed to have happened, I mean, it's interesting doing the play this time because it's much less of a problem doing it now. It's much more a relationship that younger people understand can happen and that people would talk about.
Mm.
It's much less of a problem relation. It's just as painful, I think, in fact, possibly more so.
Mm.
But it doesn't seem to be quite so much as the kind of contrived writer's thing to make certain points. It's that's what's so very interesting about how time changes plays.
Mm.
But it's clearly that when they were in their adolescence, the younger boy was in love with the older boy, who wasn't in love with him in the same way, because
exactly.
like one of them is clearly straight.
Yeah.
The play doesn't describe sex very much, but clearly something happened that would that the younger boy cannot understand how he couldn't capitalize on the red-bloodedness of his friend because it was too big a thing for him. It was not just sex.
Exactly.
And so he stopped it happening, and it is sort of. It's puzzled him ever since because he feels that the other chap could have ameliorated various problems because on the face of it they're very well suited, and that's part of the tragedy of the play, because of course that's just hard lines, because they both mop up each other's. One is very daring and yet inadequate, and the other one is not very daring and very adequate, and so they make quite an amusing, that's why they're amusing in their scenes when they're young.
Because
one gets caught climbing and has to be rescued by the less adventurous one, and then he jumps in when the tide is turning, and the other one is more competent. And so they're. So one leads the other into ideas, you know, those kinds of things going on, aren't they? And they meet, and there's this terrible sense of loss that they both have that they can't do anything about.
And in fact, the whole play evokes a lost world, firstly, and then a lost relationship, perhaps, even. Which
but you feel at the end that there's going to be an alteration, that somehow the action of the play has pushed Gerard, the younger boy, to some possibility of getting on with it.
Yeah. I mean, well, it is called small change,
yes.
But there is that element of change, isn't there?
Well, and he discusses how change is an almost impossible thing in the circumstances in which his parents lived. He didn't have the money to change much.
Well, I think that's true. I mean, I mean, both of us do remember the 60s, and there was a sudden possibility that
didn't
exist.
Yes, there was an emancipation because of the 1944-45 election. It's as simple as that, isn't it? It's why we've got to change theatre.
And talking of that, you yourself started out as an actor, and how did you come to be at the Royal Court then in the late 50s?
Well, I got interested in acting at school. I had a group of friends, and we were all what now we would call artistic. I don't think we thought of ourselves. One of us became a poet, it's called John James, one is a painter, various people did, and I went to the local drama school, and then I left because I didn't think I was learning anything, and I got a job as a young actor in various places, and then I auditioned at the Court Theatre when I was about 19, and I went and worked as an understudy and was in various things, and I got very interested in that theatre, which seemed to be the place to be, really.
And also, presumably, you found it interesting that it was a new play theatre.
Yes, I think that all came after I was there. That was the conversations going on there, the things they were doing, what they were trying to do, the seriousness, the humour, all the rest of it, the slightly barbarous atmosphere seemed to me to express something that was interesting to me. The Stratford East was a place I wanted to go and see things at because they were such enormous productions, but I never really wouldn't have been any good in that company.
Well, that was always about Joan Littlewood, wasn't it?
Whereas she wasn't a phenomenal director, Joan Littlewood. There's no doubt you never saw. I never saw a dud show there ever at the Stratford East, ever, ever. But I didn't want to sort of... The court theatre seemed to be... Yes, it was more about a lot of talent all coming together. So it seemed a good place for me to be. And that's where I worked for a long time.
And presumably you remember John Osborne and his work.
Well, I was in the next wave. They're all... It's very interesting. I have two older brothers who occupy exactly the same age as all those people. It's very, very interesting, which never dawned on me at the time. I have brothers who are 8 and 11 years older than me, and that's sort of what that group all were.
So you're more the kind of Edward Bond generation?
Yes, Carol, Churchill, me, Edward. Just trying to think who else. Alan Ayckbourn, I suppose. Alan Bennett, they're a couple of years older, but you know, we're not.
Michael Frayn, about that kind of
He's
age.
Old, yes. Yeah. Those yeah, people, war babies, we are.
Yeah.
Not bulge babies.
Yeah.
And they're all pre-war and had their adolescences, which marked it in the war, didn't they? Or just after, in a very strapped circle. They're not great. Some of them are as big beneficiaries of the Butler Act, which is all about, we are all.
Now, in 2006, you directed the 50th anniversary production of Look Back in Anger at Bath. Clearly, you think it still stands up as a play.
Well, I have a very curious relationship to John's plays. I was the assistant director on the first production of Inadmissible Evidence. In fact, I cast it, because there was no casting director at the time. When I say that, Anthony Page did, but I set it all up, and I was in the auditions that gave Nicola Williamson the part, and etc. And I had been a prompter on the production, the first production outside the court, when I first started. I was the ASM, so I knew Look Back in Anger off by heart. And a play less attractive in a way to my personality, because a boy of 18, which I was then, just 18, you know, there was this sort of man going on who was clearly middle class, who, you know, there were people, you know, he had talked about his father and a checkbook and things, and there was this sort of hetero hell going on. But the writing was amazing. He said something about what men feel about women. Whether it's what they should feel is neither here nor there, but it's a bit what Strindberg is on about. But it's about, it fascinates me, because it's about how they think women, they see themselves as sort of Protestant biblical figures. I don't know what it is in the plays, John, where the woman's going to sin in her very soul against them.
Yeah.
That there's the woman's father is going to be the always the important thing. And whatever we think, that kind of paranoia is very, very real. And to say it isn't, that's not something I have about women, but that's what and that's what he put down, really, and the first person since Strindberg to have done it. So it makes them uncomfortable plays, and the problem with Look Back in Anger is I think that there's a difference between the objective writer writing about Jimmy Porter, where it's very brilliant, where you've got the two slightly Shakespearean thing of something objective and something personal, and then the play sides with Jimmy narcissistically. When there's a moment which used to irritate me, when she says, "You make a good cup of tea," says Alison, and the other one, Helena, says, "Something Jimmy taught me," and you thought, he has to be able to make a better cup of tea than anybody else. You can't be allowed to make a good cup of tea off your own bat.
Yeah. And of course, Alison not only loses her baby, but loses the capacity to have children.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, that means that Jimmy gains a mother as well as
so it's
wife.
It's all very interesting in all the plays. I think Inadmissible is fascinating from that point of view, because it really does portray a sort of nervous breakdown in. But you know, I was present. You've just broken a memory. When I was a young actor, I worked on a production of two Willis Hall plays that John Dexter directed at the Lyric Hammersmith, designed by Sean Kenny. And the leading lady of the plays was Jill Bennett, who was married to Willis Hall.
Mm.
And in the second play with her was Pamela Lane, who was married to John Osborne. And I remember John coming to see the plays. Isn't it funny? And then he had been married to one and he married the other.
Yeah, Jill Bennett, and then famously...
Well, Pamela Lane is the woman on whom Alison Porter is meant to be based. So
that's
she was a very terribly nice woman with beautiful eyes and red hair. Well, Jill was very nice, I thought.
Mm. Mm.
But I was a boy, I didn't. This is only me observing that now, I didn't have any...
Well, apparently Pamela Lane, when she went to see Look Back in Anger and the curtain rose, and she thought, you know, her heart immediately fell, and she said, well, there was even the ironing board, you know, and of course...
Well, John Dexter, of course, is a character in Look Back in Anger, offstage character. I think he's Webster, you know.
Oh, yes, that's right, yes.
And an actor I think I directed later, a marvellous boy called John Rees, as a Welsh actor who was at Derby Rep at that time. So that's why asking about things like biology in plays is rather a dead end, because if you worked at the Court Theatre, you've met all these people and people's mothers and things. They never bear any relation, you know, whatsoever to the characters on the plays, you know. You just know that it is X's mother is in, or his first wife. A friend of mine's husband wrote a play about her. And she said, well, if only he told me when she saw it, I see what the problem is now.
Right, on that note, I think we've run out of time.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Peter Gill.